Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I'm your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And believe me, folks, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. I know that I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks to understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neural fatigue, anger, or various other symptoms of brain injury. And there are a ton of them. For me, for those of you who are new to my show, here's just a little bit of a snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005, that's 18 years ago already, more than, when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And this is the part of my intro that I always remember to tell you. Grab a pencil and a paper and keep it near you because I will often give out some URLs that you might want to look into to the show, of course. But, yeah, and there'll probably be others that I'll be popping up today, too. So definitely keep that pencil near you so you can write them down. I'll say that that blog address again, but I'll tell you, too, that it'll probably come up several times in the show. So survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and it's all one word, it's all lowercase. Make it really easy. I shared David's and my story on 4 episodes on this very show starting in August of 2014, the last of which in November of 2014 featured a discussion with David himself. I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years. And because he is a retired professor of microbiology at Columbia University, I wanted him to talk about the COVID pandemic and get his understanding of the pandemic, which we were well ensconced in at that period. So he would give us, what he would do is he would read other scientists' research on the pandemic, and then he would break it down into layman's terms, a laywoman's terms, I should say. And he'd put it out there on my blog so that people could understand what was going on and not get lost in the lingo of scientists. So, but you can find my archived shows on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click the On the Air Show menu under the category section on the right sidebar, and it's really easy. And actually, I think if I'm correct, you will find 183 shows archived there. All of them have their titles, maybe their panel, the people who are on the panel, and of course, you know, the topic that we were exploring at that time. So there's something there for everyone. So check it out, again, after the show. So if you want to find out more about David, just type his name, David Figursky, same as mine, F-I-G-U-R-S-K-I. He had the name first, so I have to give him credit for that. But you type it in the search box on the right sidebar to learn more about him. Or type any category that you're interested in the sidebar, in that search box, and it will come up, and you can find maybe articles or somebody else that has the same issue that you might be dealing with. And tonight we're going to be talking about neural fatigue. Neural fatigue will come up often on my website, well, different panels that we talked about it, et cetera, different articles that I've written. So check it out. You can also read our complete story, that means David's and my complete story, in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was released in November of 2018. And you can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as a print book and as an ebook, and most recently as an audiobook. And I got to be the reader of that audiobook, so I'm really excited about that. So you can hear my own, expressions and feelings in the book as you listen. So you can find that audiobook, well, you can find all versions of the book at your local book cons, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, your indie bookstores, or your library. And if they don't have it, shame on them. But if they don't have it, ask for it. They can order it. Okay, definitely, especially in your library. But anywhere, ask for it. They can order it. Right now, I'm doing a Goodreads giveaway. So three books will be given away, print books, to anybody who enters and wins. So obviously, there are three winners. So go check out Goodreads giveaway and check out Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You could be the lucky winner. And what I always like to say, too, is if you read the book, please write a review because and place it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend. And it helps others to know about a Goodreads. And maybe I'm hoping I wrote the book with the thought of if I can help one person, that book would be all the time and effort I put into it will be well worth it. So go to my website, DonnaFigursky.com, to learn more about me or just type in my name on Google, either Donna Figursky, Donna O'Donnell Figursky, and you will find more than you may ever want to know about me. So anyway, I hope that you're going to find my show tonight fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. So if you're in another time zone, just do your time conversion and you can listen in. Or all the shows are also archived on blogtalkradio.com. So if you go and put in Brain Injury Radio Network and on blogtalkradio.com, you will find tons and tons and tons of shows from all kinds of hosts talking about all kinds of issues that brain injury survivors and caregivers deal with. So, so check that out. And, of course, don't forget to tune in on the weekends. And we start at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on the weekends, hosts then, too. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 different countries. So we're widely listened to, and I hope that you all will make it a habit of joining us, especially on Sundays, the first and third Sunday of every month. I'd be happy. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And I hope you'll learn something from it as well. Tonight, my guest is Dr. Tamar Rodney, and Dr. Rodney is a board-certified psychiatric nurse practitioner whose focus is on trauma and psychiatry. He is an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in Baltimore, Maryland, and he is a regular contributor to brainline.org, where she not only writes articles, but she also does podcasts about various topics on brain injury. And I was lucky enough to stumble on Dr. Rodney's podcast as I was poring over the brainline.org site. And that's another URL, people, you want to write down. Brainline, one word, .org. It's a great site with so much information on it. I knew immediately when I found her there that she would be a great resource for my show, Another Fork in the Road. So I was lucky, too, when she agreed to be a guest on the show. And so with that introduction, I'm going to jump right in and welcome Dr. Tamar Rodney and let her tell you about her passion for helping people. So welcome, Dr. Rodney. I'm happy that you could join us this evening. How are you?
Hi, Donna. I'm doing fantastic, and thank you for having me to share more about a topic that's near and dear to my heart and probably will end up being my life's work, chosen, not accidental. But I'm always delighted to share what I've learned from individuals who have had a traumatic brain injury. And as the research progresses, the things that we can do to help individuals with a traumatic brain injury.
That's great. Yeah, we need people like you to commit your life to the helping people with brain injury, because it was – okay, just a second. Just one moment. I'm not wearing using your phone. Okay. All right. We're just doing some tech difficulty things here. I'm not being very clear, I guess, on the show. There's nothing much I can do about it because the earphones didn't work either. So anyhow, sorry, folks. So yeah. So I'm hoping that you will, dedicate your life work, because back in 2005, not much was really known about brain injury. I know people, knew about it in concussion, but it's come a long way since then, and I think we're going to find out some interesting facts about that today. So first thing I'd like to know about you is, how did you decide to become a nurse, an assistant professor, a writer, and a podcaster? And can you please explain all those letters that follow your name? She's got PhD. I know what a PhD is, but let's explain it anyway. And then there's PMHNP-BC. I know part of those letters. And CNE, I probably read it in your bio, but I've forgotten. So, you're very accomplished, and I'd love to know what all those letters stand for, so people know who what kind of expertise you're coming to us with.
Thank you, Donna. And usually I just go by Tamar because it has a hard time explaining the letters, but I will. So PhD, as we know, I'm a PhD prepared nurse scientist, so that's the PhD part. But before that, I worked as a nurse, and I went on to get my advanced practice degree, which comes in the specialization of psych, mental health, nurse practitioner. And so the BC just says that I'm board certified, which means that I've taken exam and kept up my credentials for that. And as if that wasn't enough, I work in, as you said, as Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. So I took further certifications to become a certified nurse educator. More about the dedication of trying to do things the right way and giving students everything they need and they want, and even when you don't know that the right thing, you try to do it in a very research-heavy way. And I think certification for the persons who know how to do it best is the way I've gone about it, because I do want to bring my best self to the classroom and to my research and to my practice. So it's not for lots of extra time, but just really wanting to make sure that whatever I do it to the best of my ability and with all the training that's possible.
Okay, well, and you did get your training, and I can see that. All those letters show a huge accomplishment, and I commend you for that.
Thank you.
Let's go into the next thing, Dr. Rodney. The nursing field is wide and varied, with so many field selections such as neonatal and pediatric or geriatric nurses, and they basically cover the spectrum of life from birth to old age. And then there are the critical care nurses, like oncology and dialysis, nurses who care for cancer or kidney disease. And surgical nurses spend their days in the operating rooms every day in every hospital in every city of the world. And, of course, there are the emergency room nurses. Again, your specialty seems to be focused on patients dealing with brain injuries and mental health issues caused by brain injuries. Can you tell us how or why that field drew you in?
You know, Donna, thanks for asking that question, because it's something that many times when I reflect on it, I think lots of strokes of luck and great mentorship that led me into a path which I absolutely enjoy. But the primary reason was because I didn't know. I didn't know enough about how individuals behave. And that scared me a little bit, and I thought, you know, if I was going to be a successful nurse, I needed to not excel in the things that I do know, but learn more about the things that I didn't. So I chose psych mental health nursing, but coincidentally, I've lived in many countries, and the United Kingdom is one of them. So I started out as a trauma nurse, which meant that I get to work with individuals with head and neck injury. So I saw lots of brain injuries. So while it wasn't my initial choice, I wanted to do the mental health portion. I was in this field and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But what I saw, Donna, was we have individuals coming in from head and neck trauma. Traumatic brain injury was most of it. And more was done in the physical healing and less in the mental health aspect. And being trained as a mental health nurse, I thought, this is not enough. We have to do more. And it's not just physical. There's an emotional aspect to this as well. And again, being trained as a nurse in multiple different clinical rotations, you want to think about the individual as a whole being, not just an arm or a leg or a head, but their experiences as well. I clearly remember a patient saying to me that after his head injury, he had to get a plate put back on to protect his brain. And he said he didn't want it because he felt like no one would remember that something was wrong. And that shook me to my very core, because that was the thing I was training to be, to get you well enough to go back through the door. But it also meant that I was neglecting a part of their need, which was their emotional health and their well-being. And so that pushed me down the road to see, how could I merge my clinical practice with the other piece that was so interesting to me, which is mental health, and how can I do more for individuals to see them as a whole person? And that led me down the path of research, and so specifically now combining traumatic brain injury and the mental health portion of that.
Wow, that's fascinating. So in some aspect, you didn't choose this and plan on it, but because you were in a rotation and you saw it and you saw the need, that directed your path. Am I correct in saying that?
Absolutely. Yeah, so, and I can remember the faces that kind of pushed me. So really it's the people that you serve and their reaction to what you're doing and wanting to do better for the next ones that you meet.
Yeah. Now, It's interesting, because prior to David's brain injury, and that happened in January of 2005, I had no clue about a brain injury. Never even heard of it. Yes, heard of concussion, but never realized the magnitude of a brain injury. And it wasn't anything brand new. I mean, people have been in car accidents, had whiplash, have fallen and tripped and hit their heads. And there have been assaults of all sorts, but yet there was never a focus on brain injury. We never really thought about that. And I was really confused. And, of course, when it happened to us, I was on the fast track of learning because I had to know as much as I could about this so that I could help David, my husband. And, so it's kind of an accidental path that I end up on because of his injury. And, because of that, too, I'm becoming more aware. And I'm trying in my best way through my blog, through my book, through my radio show here to make other people aware of brain injury. And, frankly, March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. In the United States, I don't know if it's anywhere else, but in the United States, and I always think that brain injury awareness should be happening every day because, as I mentioned earlier, 500 million people are living with brain injury. Did I say that? I don't know, I forgot. but anyhow, yeah, I say that every week, every 2 weeks, but 5 million, yeah, it's million actually. Gosh, I know I'm impressing myself with the number. Even though I know it, but I'm glad that you were able to point yourself in that direction because it's folks like you who we really need in this field. I think now brain injury has come more to the forefront in the past maybe 8 to 10 years when the troops were coming back from the Iraq War, the wars over in the Middle East. And they were coming back with IED explosion of traumas. And people started to take notice of them. And then, of course, when all the football players started to get autopsies and have the chronic encephalopathy, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, yeah. And then that became the news, and that was on the news every night. So that became in the forefront, and we started to learn a little bit more about brain injury, and I think the public started to know a little bit more about it, which unfortunately happens, but I guess it was happening anyway, so I guess it's good that it came out so now that people can at least acknowledge it and know it. But what you said before, and I might be going ahead of myself here, but you said, people would acknowledge the physical part of the brain injury when they could see it. For example, David has a balance challenge, and it's very difficult for him to walk. One part of his face is kind of paralyzed, so it droops on one side. He's got a crooked smile, is what we always say. And various other physical disabilities that make it obvious to folks that there's something happened. But there are a lot of people that don't have the outward signs of brain injury, and the invisible brain injury, which is, I don't know whether it's harder or not, but it's definitely equal to the physical for sure, having that kind of thing because of the mental stresses that happen. And despite the fact that David has a lot of outside physical, and we actually only thought basically in that vein for a long time, but then we started thinking again, he has a lot of disabilities that are inside that people don't see, and they can't even have a clue that he's going through those things. And some of those things I'm going to get into a little bit later. I'm really glad that you're able to be able to do that and bring it to the attention of folks, too. Do you have anything to add to that, or I'm going to move on?
Yeah, so the thing I wanted to say, particularly about you choosing to share about David and making this an avenue where people can access information, is that you briefly mentioned veterans and football players, which I was lucky enough to do my initial research with the veteran population. When you compare them to veterans and football, it's still a very select group of individuals, and there's a lot riding in both of those professions. And less is known about how everyday individuals experience this. I often call it the wound you cannot see, because frequently you don't have a Band-Aid to show you that something happened. And individuals are also living with brain injuries that they didn't even know that they have.
I know.
And a lot of times, multiple.
That's so true.
Right. So it's it's important that we acknowledge that it's been going on for a very long time. People have car accidents and falls every day, and we're thankful that we have research dedicated to a lot in veterans research, a lot in football players. CTE, at that point, it's too late, I will say. And so now we have an opportunity to address it before it's autopsy and address it for everyday individuals who may not know why that they behave the way they behave and what it might be attributed to.
Yeah. No, you know, I have an example of that from somebody I interviewed, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 years ago, a woman named Deb who was in a car accident. She was sitting at a light, and she was, you know, just waiting for the light to turn when somebody was texting or messaging or something. They were distracted in one way or another, and they ran into her, the back of her car. She experienced the whiplash, which nobody ever realized. You know, she went to the doctor, the hospital, whatever, and they said, well, you've got a whiplash, you'll be fine. Sent her home, and it wasn't until about 2 years later when she continued to do her research and tried to find out, what is the matter with me? This wasn't how I was before the day before the accident. And now all of a sudden she's experiencing what she called brain fog. What she said was, you know, I'd become confused. I'd walk into a room with lights on, and I would go, it would really bother her, or noises would bother her, and she didn't know what was happening in her life. And that went on for 2 years until she finally figured it out, got her information to a doctor who actually listened, and they sorted it out so that she was able to get the care that she needed to help her with those problems. So that was an invisible brain injury. And like you said, a lot of people don't even know they have it, but there's something going on that just doesn't jive. It just isn't quite this, what it should be. And you just don't know what to do about it. And, you know, that happens a lot when you go to a doctor and you've got something going on, but it's not real common. And they can't put their finger on it right away. And you go to this doctor and this doctor and this doctor. And maybe you'll meet somebody that actually has experienced it in their career. And that just brings a quick story up. When I was pregnant, I had just had my second child, my son, and I had a cold, and I was coughing a lot. And I coughed and coughed and coughed until I broke a rib. My husband took me to, we were in San Diego at the time, we lived there, and took me to the San Diego Hospital, whatever it was called, and in the emergency room, and they sent me home with aspirin and said, you know, I think they thought I was making it up or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, I went home and any movement I made, because it's a cracked rib, any movement I made was horrendous. It was like a knife searing through you. But so he took me back to the emergency room, and I happened to be lucky enough to find a doctor, the one that happened to be on call that night, who said, I know what you have. You have a hairline fracture. It's not showing up on the x-rays, but that's what you have.
Wow.
And that's causing you the pain. So not a whole lot that she could do about it, because I was nursing him and you couldn't wrap it or anything. But at least at that point, I was able to get help from a friend who came over, her daughter, my friend's daughter came over and after school and would help with Jared, you know, picking him up and putting him in my arms and things like that. So I was able to heal eventually. But that's the kind of thing. People just don't know, they don't see. And you can't blame everybody for not knowing everything, because everyone's learning as we go through.
Right.
But that's just another little, you know, just another little aside, that sometimes you just don't know what it is that you're dealing with until you keep looking, basically like Deb did.
If you go back to that car accident incident, that's a classic. Because falls and car accidents are the primary reasons we have brain injuries to begin with. But if you take it in the context of specifically the car accident, we're looking for cuts, scrapes, and bruises. Did you break an arm?
and also a hopefulness that everything is fine. And if that individual is able to speak to you, normally a brain injury is not suspected. But the head wasn't meant to go back and forth. And the clinical term is cool contra cool, when you know your head goes forward and it slams back, which it's a very dangerous weight and you can cause significant damage. And so that happens so frequently. Sometimes it's a shock of it that you want everything to be okay. And after you've been released from the hospital and you're home and you start to feel those symptoms, sometimes you dismiss them yourself because you don't know. You're not supposed to know. You're not the clinician necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so it could go on for years. And we also mask things. You know, if I'm not sleeping so well, could it be something else? So the automatic is never that my head got injured. But the other part is frequently when there's an injury to the head, we don't remember. And that is a consequence of brain injuries, memory loss.
Yeah.
So we can't quite put into words the thing that has happened to us, nor anyone might have seen. But the assumption is, at least from my perspective, we have an opportunity to treat the individual as a whole human being. And a car accident, there should be an assumption that there's other injuries that we don't see. That's why we have progressed to things like MRI and CT scans to give us a better vision of the things that we can't see with the naked eye or depend on our memory or an eyewitness to tell us what happened. So I try to keep that perspective at all times to utilize everything that is available to me to make sure I'm being thorough and giving that space to individuals who've had a brain injury to come back. You know, things might not show up a week, a month, a year, but if you do feel this way, come back and find out. And we medicine has advanced for us to get answers quicker. But I think it also takes a different approach about how we treat brain injuries and how we treat individuals in the healthcare scheme to make better decisions, not just about brain injury, but especially around brain injuries.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really good advice. So if you're not feeling right, you've had an incident and something is bothering you, check it out. It's better to have it checked out and find out that nothing's wrong than to let it go and just, you know, cause your life a lot of distress, basically, to be going through these things. I mean, this woman was devastated because, you know, her life had changed so drastically and she didn't quite understand why. And, you know, just she had to take breaks in her office and just go into a dark, quiet room by herself just to get, you know, calmed back down again enough to be able to do the job that she was doing. So, and that's just one example there. So, so definitely, you know, keep checking it out if there's something not quite right going on.
Right.
Another thing I want to talk about as well is the fatigue that goes on with brain injury. And we both know that each brain injury is unique. And because of the complexity of the brain, an organ that is responsible for every action of our bodies, and because injury to any part of our brain can cause multiple symptoms, folks with brain injuries face many, many challenges. And depending on where the insult to the brain was determines what types of havoc will occur. And so, for example, if the frontal lobe, the area of the brain directly behind the forehead, is damaged, a survivor is often faced with personality, emotional, or mental disorders. Impulsivity and impairments in judgment often occur. A myriad of other afflictions, including depression, low motivation, distractibility, all of those can happen. And these disorders often have extending consequences for the survivor. And one such symptom is fatigue. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to talk with you about today. But fatigue is something that we can all relate to. I mean, after a long day at work, many of us complain of being exhausted. After leaving my classroom of 26 first graders, I often wished I could sleep for a week. But my kind of tiredness
And then, well, yeah, believe me. But I loved it. I loved it. Like you loved your job and you love what you do.
Yeah.
I loved every minute of that. So yeah. So even though I was tired, it was a good tired. But when when that kind of tiredness happens and people complain of fatigue, it's called. No, I'm losing my train of thought right now. That exhaustion that is called neural fatigue is also referred to as cognitive or mental fatigue. And now I'm not talking about my kind of tiredness. I'm talking about the tiredness that brain injury survivors often complain about. It's an exhaustion that is well beyond anything that I ever felt when I came home from my 26-year-old first graders. Well, no, they're not 26 years old. My 26 six-year-old first graders. So anyhow, sometimes I acted 26, but no. A person who is talking, a survivor who's talking about fatigue and exhaustion is not talking about the everyday exhaustion that ordinary folks feel. We all feel tired at times, but we're talking about a neural fatigue that is way beyond what anybody that doesn't have it can even identify with. So can you talk to us about that? What is the difference between just the exhaustion that I felt when I came home, the tiredness, and the exhaustion that a brain injury survivor is experiencing?
That is an excellent question. And like you said, let's break it down first is what I like to do, neuro fatigue.
Okay.
Neuro really refers to the brain, and fatigue is our everyday word. So in the best, simplest form, you can think about it being mentally exhausted or your brain is tired. But you specifically said it's different. It's different from feeling physically tired. And the difference really is if you're physically tired, usually it means that I need rest. I need more rest. That usually solves it. And you wake up tomorrow and you feel energetic and you feel energized and you're ready to go again. With neuro fatigue, it doesn't work that way. And so rest won't help. The other piece is that it affects specific parts of how you function, how you think and remember things is different simply because your brain feels overwhelmingly tired. It also affects you physically. You can't do the things you normally do. It makes you emotionally unbalanced is what I'm going to say. You're not yourself anymore. But one of the big areas that this affects is your sleep. And so as we're physically tired, sleep is the go-to or taking a rest. But neuro fatigue, with it comes sleep disturbances. So the thing that is supposed to help you, you can't even get that as well. So doing things that you normally would do becomes such a chore. It becomes, on Brainline, one of the podcasts I do, I think one of the best description I've heard of is you feel like you're swimming through oatmeal. It's not that you don't want to, or you can't. It's just that it feels so very difficult to get things done.
Yeah.
But there's a physical component as well. And so usually we hear the other terminology that refers to this is brain fog. That you feel like your brain is in a fog, really, because nothing is very clear and you can't accomplish the things that you want to do. When you're coming out of a physical injury, some of this is expected and is not quickly attributed to mental exhaustion. It's attributed to the physical. We don't really know fully why we have neuro fatigue, and there are different theories around this, that the brain is still healing. It takes a really long time for it to heal. But we truly don't know what it is. So we have to go from the approach of, what do you do to still function and hoping that the symptoms subside? So your brain is not working the way it
can. Yeah. That was, you answered it. I was going to ask you what causes neural fatigue, but you're saying that we really don't know at this point. That was my next question. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the natural piece, because we want to solve. We know what is happening, but we don't know how to fix it because we don't know the root cause. So there's no one thing to say that this is the cause of it. If we take it down to the brain, you know, our brain is made up of a massive network of neurons. And so one of the theories is that there's damage to the neurons and those haven't been reconnected or healed yet. And so we're still trying to function, and that exhausts the brain a little bit more. So it's complex. It's not hopeless, but it is certainly a very intricate and delicate position to work with, because we want to just get on with our daily lives. But we also need to give the body a chance to heal.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. You know, in my journeys around the web, as I was reading tons of articles on neural fatigue, which I do every few, about every 6 months or so, because I'm always trying to attack this topic in different ways. But I realized that neural fatigue is much like, or it can be compared maybe, to the operation of a computer. And so let me explain that, because I think it's kind of interesting. And you touched on some of that a few minutes ago. But after, take a computer, and after fully charging all night, the computer has a full battery of energy. And like a person who has gotten a restful night's sleep, it's ready to go. Okay. So, but as the day wears on and time passes, the computer gets a wee bit slower. Things are harder to accomplish. But as more and more programs are open throughout the day, the computer's charge begins to wear down even more. So I think daily activities, you know, getting dressed in the morning, preparing and eating breakfast, cleaning up afterwards, that just begins the very, very, very beginning of the day. And, you know, maybe somebody can do that pretty easily because it's early and there's lots of energy. Think chores, making the bed, running errands, doctor's appointments, carpooling kids to school, or sports activities. I did a lot of all of those at some point. But think of all of these activities and chores as running programs. For example, Microsoft Word, which I use a lot of, my internet browser, mail program, everybody's checking their mail, dictionary and thesaurus. As a writer, I'm always checking into the dictionary and thesaurus, so it's always on call and ready to run. So when open and running, they each drain power on the energy of the computer's battery. And the battery can only hold so much charge. And when it's gone, the computer shuts down. It doesn't give you a, do you want to stay open or anymore? You know, it just shuts down. You have to recharge it again. You've got to hit that, put that plug back in and get some more charge, which you can do during the day. But a person who has been doing all of this stuff and is like that computer, and it can't just plug right back in. So that's what happens when someone experiencing neural fatigue that's what's happening to them too, I think. Too many activities drain the energy. So what can you do about that? And so, Dr. Rodney, that's one of the things I wanted. Can you elaborate on that theory? You're agreeing with me. I was going to ask you if it even made sense, but it sounds like you are buying into that one. So
it's a beautiful analogy.
Can you offer suggestions on how someone can tackle it every day, the neural fatigue?
I love that analogy. Normally I go with a cell phone because I always take it off the charger, but I do like that because it means that, one, we have to be careful about multitasking, just acknowledging that all the things that we would want to do all at once is going to make us a little bit more tired. Two is, after a good night's rest, we're going to find more of our energy in the morning. And so one of the great ways, thinking about this analogy, which I love so much, is that in order to get the things, first we're going to prioritize. Give yourself a little bit of grace and acknowledging that your body still needs time to heal. But if there are things that you need to get done, they're going to be done early in the morning. That's one. And pacing yourself. And so instead of doing five different things to drain that battery, we're going to do two, the most important two. It's a hard thing to accept, I will tell you, especially if you're speaking to someone who was probably an executive or a very busy parent who was doing 5-6 different things at the same time. Sometimes when I think about what I do, I feel like I'm doing multiple jobs. And so an acceptance of restructuring our day and essentially our lives, and while you're doing that, we get to do the most important things, but also you're allowing your body enough time to heal over a longer time. It also means that if we do that, we will be able to concentrate a little bit more on the task at hand, because concentrating and memory are some of the things that come with neurofatigue. We're not able to concentrate as much, and we feel that we're not able to think clearly. So if we limit the amount of tasks we're doing and limit the number of tasks we're doing and the time of day we're doing it, it gives us a better shot at doing something and not running out of battery, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I want to get into a little bit of that in a different angle in a few minutes. But yeah, I think people do have to give themselves grace and not be so hard on themselves when they can't complete what they need to do, because it's, your brain is working hard. It's working extra hard because of the injury. So, yeah. I just got distracted here because I'm looking out my window and a coyote just walked up to my bush and started eating some of it. He's like, oh, my God, this is only like 15 feet away from where I'm sitting, but I'm inside. But, yeah, they walk around our neighborhood, and not real often that I see them, but it's like, oh, my God, there's a coyote there. I want a picture, but I can't do it right now. So anyhow, another see how easily distracted I am? Not really. I was listening to everything you said. Okay. So anyhow, another problem that comes up with this is because the person is not accomplishing what he or she wants to do, thinks they can do, it compounds the problem of survivors experiencing the neurofatigue, because they often present with a lack of motivation, and that makes them feel as if they are slacking or not being responsible for their daily activities. And they also fear others, their family, their friends, will also perceive them as being lazy. And that's not usually the case. It's not that they're lazy. It's just that they can't get the motivation. They don't have the energy to do it. Still, those survivors often face uncontrollable physical or mental sluggishness and feel guilty that they feel that way. In fact, I'm going to go back to my husband on an example here, because after many years, And this is what kind of surprised me, is the many years part. My husband David admitted to me that he was plagued with feelings of insecurity because he struggled to keep up with his life the way it was before his brain injury. Now, before January of 2005, David was a very active middle-aged man. He loved his job as a professor of microbiology at Columbia University. He loved spending weekends behind the wheel of open-wheeled race cars, and in many states, he raced in many states in the Northeast. He enjoyed exercising and running 20 miles a week up and down the hills of our neighborhood in New Jersey. And he had a positive and energetic attitude about life. After his brain injury, he struggled with even the most mundane of things. He was worn out by walking across the room. He was worn out by talking with folks. And even eating his daily meals took a toll on his strength. He'd always tell me, it's hard. It's hard to talk. It's hard to eat. You know, and I was like, for me, without the brain injury, it's like, how is it hard to talk? Well, David does have, like I said, paralysis on his right side of his face, so he does bite the inside of his lips a lot, or his cheek, or his tongue, which makes it difficult. But it's not only that, it's just, keeping up a conversation normally would have prior to his injury. That's basically what it is. And this, it took a toll on him, on his strength and on his feelings. And it was still, it wasn't, and actually it still is a huge blow for a man so accomplished and confident in life. And David's not alone. I'm not, you know, I'm telling you his example, but I bet you that any listener out there, there are a lot of them nodding their heads. You know, they maybe didn't race cars or be at a university, but they had things that they loved to do, that they wanted to continue to do. And it was kind of erased from their lives because of the fatigue that was coming through. So I'm wondering, how can survivors understand that this lack of motivation or sluggishness or laziness or call it what you want, is a problem of their brain injury and not their persona? How can they change the negative feelings that they harbor about themselves? Any clues on that one?
Donna, I take it from a very philosophical perspective, to be honest with you, that whenever I am working with someone and there's a sense of frustration and feeling overwhelmed, I hone in on those as excellent qualities. And so it's the exact opposite of being lazy. It's a frustration because that drive to do is still there, which means that motivation mm-hmm. still lies there, but not being able to accomplish it triggers this frustration. And I want that to stay there. I want that to be the fuel that says, I will still drive to do, but then we reframe what that to do is. So just shifting that narrative of being lazy is the exact opposite. But saying that to the individual is not enough. That conversation needs to also happen with the people around them. So they better understand what is neurofatigue,
yes.
what is brain fog, why can't they do, why is this feeling of exhaustion and being overwhelmed. But channel those energies into, I am still motivated to do, even though it's frustrating for me. But the second piece of this is really around finding what, I call it the new purpose in life. And so accepting, uh-huh. first of all, and this is hard. What I'm saying is hard, that we are most likely after a brain injury, we will have to change what our life was before. But that doesn't mean that our life now or the life after brain injury doesn't still have purpose in it. So we are mm-hmm. recreating a new purpose in life. And that's a very individualized journey as to what that looks like. And so maybe running might not be something I can accomplish anymore, but I could be a supporter for runners or a trainer for runners, still using some of those skills. But ultimately, uh-huh. what it really comes down to is practicing self-care. And so less of what individuals expect of me and more about taking care of me to get to that purpose. So it's not necessarily, oh, you need to sleep more, stay hydrated, or exercise. Yes, those are pieces that we would always encourage, but a shift in philosophy as to how we approach the injury and how we mentally rehabilitate as to what life is after, getting to a process of acknowledging that there are some physical components that we have no control over. There's a biological basis about this, that regardless of what we do, we will have no control over a little bit of letting go and reframing what life looks like for you.
Hey, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because, and you touched on this part too, is how you know, the people around you also need to know that mm-hmm. it's not your laziness or sluggishness, your lack of motivation. It's not, that's not really happening, like you said, because David doesn't express, he feels that, but it's not him. It's not what he right. does. It's not what he wants to be. And yet sometimes other people will perceive him as not trying hard enough, and it hurts mm-hmm. because I see him as being an amazing person who tries everything that he can, and for 18 years to continue to do this, is very uplifting and heartening. So he, you know, he realizes that, and you mentioned something about a new path. I was going to write that down, and I didn't get my pen didn't work. So, or reframing your life. And that's something that I see that David did, because he, when he had his brain injury, he was still a professor at Columbia. And, of course, that kicked him out of the lab for quite a while. He had 3 brain surgeries, wasn't expected to live through any of them, and he returned to work a year and a half later, which was phenomenal. He didn't, no one expected that. The doctors told me that. And, but he did, because that's his strength. And I think that's what saved his life, frankly, too, saved his being as he is now. But, you know, so that's something that you have to do, but it also caused him a lot of frustration because he wasn't able to do as many things as he wanted to do. And I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit, and I'll probably want to go back. Taking David, because you mentioned frustration, and it's taken David many years, 18 of them actually, more than 18 years to be precise, to realize that he can only do so much in a day. And if you could see his to-do list, his long list was a huge cause of frustration because he beat himself up when he could only accomplish a task or two on the list each day. And the list kept growing and growing. Mm-hmm. And he finally came to terms and realized that he did his best work in the morning and became less efficient by mid-afternoon. So he rearranged his day to do his most important cognitive work in the mornings and did more menial tasks in the afternoon, which is exactly what you just said a few lines ago. But, for example, David he's the first reader and the editor for all my books. Mm-hmm. Now, that's all cognitive. Okay. That's all cognitive strength in any articles that I write. And that takes huge concentration. So he does any editing first thing in the morning. And he makes the bed, does the laundry, or any mindless chores later in the day. And he finds that works best for him. But he was a morning person even before the injury. Like me, I work best at night. So I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on work schedules? In your work, have you noticed a better time of day for survivors to reach their optimum efficiency? We both kind of agree that for David, it's the morning. Is that pretty much what, and we talked about the computer having most energy in the morning. So do you think that is what people should focus on, trying to get things done early?
Absolutely. So two things before we move on. I can't overestimate or overshare the power of podcasts like this and the power of platforms like this to share stories, to have caregivers understand, and the general public. You don't need to be a caregiver to respond empathetically to someone who's going through this. So it could be a friend or a distant contact to better understand these little nuanced meaning about an individual saying, you know what, I can only do things until noon. And that's understood into the context of a better understanding of traumatic brain injury works. And I think half of the frustration is there, that people simply don't understand. And while the science has progressed, there's still so much more to know, to share, to be confident about speaking about without feeling shame or feeling less than or feeling as not a productive part of society. So a huge plug for making platforms like these more public and share more and have more of these platforms to talk about individuals like David, to share his story, and not just the story, but the journey of how long it took to get to this realization. So that's incredibly important. So getting back to this, you know, you're charging your phone or your computer overnight, it still remains that you're going to have your biggest boost of energy in the morning. And again, the prioritizing is going to be very, very key. Not pushing yourself to complete a task because of someone else's need, but because of what you're used to. So you could potentially break a task up. So you probably get your second wind maybe at 2 in the afternoon if you have a little rest. and do that. So it becomes an individualized process that we're saying to you that most likely your best energy is going to be in the morning. So do all the hard work. Do the reading then. But there are other things in life. Some people are still parents, and parenting never finishes. Accepting help is a huge piece, because we paint this in a box of, you know, I do, I need to do, I will do. But again, this piece about how much we can do and being in an environment where it's okay to ask for help and accept help to make things still go on. And that's a much harder thing to do, but it's a part of learning and a part of the journey as well, and a part of educating the others, individuals around us, to be a little bit more accepting or understanding of, it's not laziness, it's not that I'm not motivated, it's because it's a symptom of my injury, whether you can see it or not. This is a symptom of my body still healing, even though it's been years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a thing that I see with a lot of people, is that they don't realize that it's taking a toll on David. They think that if he tried harder, he'd be able to walk, you know, for example. And he has a very difficult time walking because he had a cerebellum injury in his brainstem. So that is causing his balance to be affected. And so he has a very difficult time keeping his balance and staying upwards. So it's that's why, you know, I say walking across the room is really hard for him. It takes every neuron in his brain to concentrate. So, and people think that, well, if you practice harder, or when we're outside, for example, I'm walking with him, I hold him. But sometimes other people have to take him if I'm not there, and they don't take the same type of care or attention, because they think he can do it if he tried, so I'm going to let him try.
Right.
It's like throwing the baby into the deep end of the pool and say he's going to swim. Well, if the baby has no ability at all, mentally or physically or anything, that baby's going to drown. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with David.
Mm-hmm.
He just can't walk. He can walk on flat surfaces like an institutional building, you know, that's level. Our home, of course, is level, not carpeting. Carpeting is hard. But walking outside where the sidewalks have cracks or slopes or stones or twigs, all of that kind of stuff is just a danger. And it's an invitation for him to fall and hurt himself again. And I just fear that always, that he might hit his head again. And then what? You know, we're already deep in this thing. We don't need any more. So that's kind of a thing. How do you get people to understand that? I mean, can you even get them to understand that?
I'm an eternal optimist. And I think I didn't know anything about brain injury apart from I need to take care of them so they can get to rehab, not knowing what happens at rehab, until I knew more. I will remain forever hopeful that we will, as the science progress and individuals are brave enough to talk about it, that more people will know about what brain injury does and the longer lasting effect of brain injury. It's not just going to the hospital and coming back home and everything is fine. It's a chronic process. So that remains, and I think the amount of persons who probably listen tonight who know a little bit more means that there's a different response, even in a small way. So I remain hopeful about that process. Also, less stigma around not being able to do the things that we need to do, or feeling less than, and getting to, again, a process, a mental and physical process, to get to the point to say that I am allowed to push back. I'm not lazy. I am trying my hardest, and verbalizing that to say to someone else who's expecting more of me, no, I will not push myself too far because I don't want an injury. And for those who have the voice to say so, they should, but also for the individuals around them who have that voice, they should also say so unapologetically as well, that this is my new normal. I'm finding my new life's purpose. and I will go at the pace that my body dictates to me, and I will still try, even though I get frustrated, but allow me to get frustrated with myself. So some of that is just having that confidence to push back knowingly to say, I will schedule things according to my day's energy level, not according to what you want me to do. And that principle applies to so many other things in life, but certainly should be a part of how we practice self-care. It sounds like just eating and doing exercise, but it's also an emotional response to how we allow others to treat us or how others make us feel because of their lack of understanding. It's one of the ways that we help them understand to say, this is a product of my injury, and there's a process that I go through, and there's a new normal for me, and my life looks very different now, but I'm going to live it to the fullest, to the limit at which I can do that.
Great answer. And David isn't so likely to make those comments aloud to other people, but I do. So
great.
I do let them know that, you know, this is what he can do, and I don't want him to get hurt, and I am not being the overprotective wife or, you know, that sort of thing. I'm not, you know, restricting him in any way because I know the damage and what can happen and where David's life can go if something does happen like that. Like I mentioned, you know, he needs me to walk him outside. I have to tell him often where the curb is or if there is that rock or a slant in the road because his eyes are also affected. So that to compound that with his balance issues and then his vision problems, I always tell it, say, to, you know, I'm like a seeing eye dog, you know. I will guide him and tell him where the road is slanting and things like that, where the sidewalk is slanting. And I think, and I tell people that when you're walking with him, you need to do that. You need to let him know. Because if he gets to the end of the curb, he's not going to see it, you know. So you have to warn him. Otherwise, he's going to take that step, and you're actually both going to go down. So, and that's not something I'm willing to take a chance on. Because if he hurts his head again, I don't know where we're going to end up, you know, at that point.
Right.
What more damage can we have? So, yeah, we are both careful. We're both very careful with that. But I think that that's something that other people need to understand, that he's not doing it because he wants to. He's doing it because he needs to. You know, he has to. Otherwise, you know, and that's basically what you just said, too. I want to ask this question really quickly, and it's a kind of what comes first question, the chicken or the egg, okay? If you can give any light on this. If a survivor is suffering from neural fatigue, does that cause lack of motivation? Or is lack of motivation caused by the same mechanism that causes neural fatigue?
That's a very interesting question.
And
this idea of lack of motivation is, there's a physical component to it, because if you just don't have the energy to do something, it just won't be there. You can't make it up. But the frustration that comes with neural fatigue as well means that it's hard for me to try the next time. I will say one of the best things that happened with someone who is experiencing neural fatigue is that sense of frustration, because it tells you that they are still motivated to try, and it drives them bananas that they can't do that thing that they're trying to do. So I will forever say that is the fighting spirit. That is not lack of motivation. That is fantastic. Where I see this very frequently is, you mentioned briefly about the change in personality. One of the most joyous things for me on treating my patients with a traumatic brain injury is when they come back and they start to curse, which is a very surprising thing that I'm like, one, they can speak, which makes me so motivated for them. But two, it tells you that there's a fighting spirit in there, that they are objecting to something that you said or they don't agree, which means that they're getting back their independence.
And so while they're cursing, and, you know, some persons will look at you and say, oh, you must be losing your mind as well. I'm like, no, this is what I want to see. This is the motivation that you want from this person to still say, I don't agree with you. And no, leave me alone, because they are still motivated, even though they're not able to do that thing. So we have to be gentle, because it affects both emotionally and physically. There is a physical depletion of energy that comes with it, and there's also an emotional depletion of drive. So it's both ways, and I think in many ways it's harder when it's neurofatigue, because it's both. But when you have that feeling of being overwhelmed, it gives you a starting point to say, I will do this again. And when you have that feeling of being frustrated, it means that I am still willing to try, because this is something that means something to me. So I'm looking for the crisis that creates an opportunity to say, yes, that oomph is still there, although it's not coming out in the way that they want it to.
All right, that's cool. Okay, and we're going to be closing out pretty soon. I think I have 10 more minutes, because I don't think anybody's scheduled after me right now. So my last question to you, my last question to you is, neurofatigue is such a devastating symptom of brain injury. I think we can all agree on that. And the Brain Injury Association of America, which is BIAAUSA.com. BIAAUSA. I'm not sure, but I didn't mark it down. I just wrote what I remembered. It states anyhow that about 98% of brain injury survivors complain of mental exhaustion, even after doing a simple chore like feeding the dog or washing a small load of dishes. And we talked about some of this earlier. But this kind of exhaustion is debilitating, and it can cause feelings of depression. We talked about these kinds of things happening and causing frustration, but they also can cause depression. So what happens, and how do you care for a person who is presenting with signs of depression because of his or her brain injury?
Thank you for saying that, because it's one of the number one symptoms that come with after brain injury. Post-traumatic stress disorder is another one that comes as well.
Yes.
As well as the shame and stigma, if there's a physical scar. So there's multiple things that can trigger symptoms of depression. One of the ways I approach this is knowing which one is a priority for that individual and how much it affects the way they live their daily lives. And so think of self-depression doesn't mean that I'm going to throw antidepressants at them. It means that there are other ways we can look at it. Some individuals want to say, you know, I feel symptoms of depression, but I would prefer to gain my walking strength back. Medication is not the fix for everything, and I'm a prescriber. Medications do work, but I allow the individual to tell me how I should coordinate their care. What is more important to them? Is it that they want to go back to work as a fitness instructor, or is it that they want to have more days where they feel energetic, and so maybe starting a round of antidepressants, short-term or long-term, is something that they're willing to try. But accepting that there's multiple issues. One, because it's the brain, there's a biological basis when the brain is damaged. Serotonin, dopamine, and every other neurotransmitter is interrupted. Mm-hmm. And so there is a chemical change, again, most of which we have no control over. And so that is why there's such a high rate of depressive symptoms and PTSD with traumatic brain injury. But in coordinating care for them, I want them to tell me what is the most important thing for them to work on now, as opposed to me telling them that you have symptoms of depression, we should fix that now. And acknowledging that there's many other ways to do this, including therapy, including looking at their physical self, but medication should be a part of that regime as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I like that fact of meditation. Oh, you said medication.
Medication, but therapy as well. I'm a big supporter of therapy.
Meditation.
Yeah, no, meditation is a part of a therapeutic response. but certainly utilizing everything we can for that individual. One of the things that I do in my practice is what I call narrative therapy. And when I spoke about creating your new purpose, it allows us to do that. Like for narrative, how do you rewrite the narrative of your life that might include the way things are, but the way you want them to be? And as a therapeutic approach, trying to create your new normal and trying to find your new purpose in life with your injury, not despite of, not because of, but with, acknowledging that this is a part of who you are, not something you're trying to get rid of. So thinking about them as a whole person as opposed to just their injury.
Being there, I'm really excited about that. I wish we had more time to talk. This has been a very interesting and very informative chat with you, Dr. Rodney, and I'm very excited that you came on the show. I said that before, and I'm reiterating it now. So I thought nobody was coming on after me, but I just got a message that they are, so I'm not sure. So we may get cut off, but I'm going to push it to the end. Do you have any, well, I'm not even going to ask you that. I was just going to say, do you have any parting words? Maybe I will ask you. Any parting words, but only for like 30 seconds to offer our audience.
Stigma related to traumatic brain injury and mental health symptoms still remains. Misunderstanding of what traumatic brain injury is and the after effects still remains. And we need to continue to educate individuals who've had a traumatic brain injury, clinicians who take care of individuals, as well as their caregivers and families, to have a different approach to how we take care of individuals with brain injury and to acknowledge all the complexities that come with it, because it's with that understanding that care and outcomes become much better.
Okay, thank you. And is there any place on the web where you can tell people that they can contact you or locate you or find out about your podcast? Did you have a URL that we can share?
Of course. So you can look for me on the web at Tamar Rodney at Johns Hopkins University and School of Nursing, as well as BrainLine is an excellent resource as well. So BrainLine, one word, as you mentioned, .org. They also have wonderful information on brain injury and all the complexities that come with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love BrainLine. I'm there once a week at least looking around. So, thank you very much for being a part of the show tonight. We really appreciate everything you offered. And you can, just to do my housekeeping at the end, you can read interviews about TBI survivors and caregivers at my blog on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. There are all kinds of categories there, tons and tons of interviews from caregivers and survivors. And if you wish to be interviewed there, just contact me at donnaodonnell@gmail.com. Again, just look me up on the web and you'll get the whole thing. So you can read about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, at my website, donnafigurski.com. And that page will even give you a cast of characters, so you can actually see all the characters that were in the book. True story, true memoir of how my husband survived 3 brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks. On the next show, it will be a panel show, and pull up that calendar really fast. It will be on April 2nd, and we will be talking about what survivors and caregivers want to hear and don't want to hear. So please join us for that panel. That should be a very interesting chat as well. Remember to tune in every second and fourth Sunday at 5:30 p.m. to listen to, that's Pacific time, to listen to Lisa Dreyer. She is the host of Mesh with MS. And again, my shows on the first and third Sundays of every month. And next up, it should be Dr. Valentina and Coach KJ on their show called Moving Forward. They follow me on the third week. So if you loved my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me too. So I'll see you on April 2nd, same time, same station. And Dr. Tamar Rodney, thank you once more. for joining us tonight and sharing such interesting knowledge that you have.
My absolute pleasure, Donna, and my best wishes as David continues his recovery.